welcome to the Hull Libraries podcast. In this episode, we had a chat with wonderful author, poet, and performer Paul Cookson. We talked to Paul about transitioning from full-time teacher to full-time poet, the unexpected success of his massive lockdown-inspired poetry project, and a second career of sorts in music, featuring surprise collaborations with childhood heroes along the way.
Yeah, I've done lots of work with you over the years, but then I've done lots of work with everybody over the years because I've been doing it for lots of years. In fact, I've got to the stage where I go to schools and teachers have said to me, I'm glad you've come in because you came to my last school. To which I say, oh, where did you teach? And they said, no, I was in year four as a child. I remember you coming in. So I've been doing this since 1989. I was a full-time teacher. But always wrote poetry, but not necessarily for children at that particular stage. In the 80s, it was the era of what they called alternative cabaret, where I suppose people like, the likes of Jack D and Joel Brand and Steve Coogan. In fact, I once did a gig with Steve Coogan. I was on the same bill as Steve Coogan. I wasn't that good. I could do it now because I wasn't really an adult performer in that sense. I did quite serious poems and they wanted comedy, whereas I could probably do that now. But anyway, so I was doing that, but I was teaching and I met various other writers and some of them worked in schools. And I was at the stage where I thought, oh, well, I don't want to get to 50 and think, could I have done something with my writing? So I pondered about becoming a part-time teacher and trying something with the writing. But one of these poets, a guy called Ian McMillan, actually, from Barnsley, who does a lot of stuff with Radio 4, a lot of children's poetry, does The Verb on Radio 4. But I remember him saying to me, well, why don't you work in schools? You're a teacher. You know how to work in schools. You know how to work with kids. You can write poems. And that sort of changed my standpoint in writing poems, really, because I started writing poems for children. And I made the brave step, because I wasn't married then, so if I starved or I was cold, it was just me. But I made the brave step of going down to part-time teaching. So I went down from 5 days a week to 3 days a week. And so 2 days were for freelance work, which for the year, first year, I got nothing at all, because nobody's heard of you. But what I did do, I started writing poems for children. And then I wrote round to all my local primary schools and said, look, can I come in free just for an hour with the class, try them out? Because that's one of the things, you know, you can sit at home thinking I've got a really good poem, but until you try it out in front of an audience, you don't know how good it is. And it was interesting. The poems that I thought were good poems, and they were good poems, or they were decent poems, they weren't the best ones that worked in front of an audience. The ones that worked in front of an audience were the ones that had a joke in, or the ones that had audience participation. So over that 2 years, I was trying material out. And then I got a couple of bookings here and there. And it's a bit like any business, whether you're a painter and decorator, a mobile hairdresser or a mechanic or whatever. It's word of mouth. You know, somebody says, oh, you know, I need me hall painting. Have you had a decorator? Oh, we had them and they were reliable. Well, you have the converse as well. He said, they're very good at writing, but they're no good in front of children, you know, because you get that of people who are great writers, but are not performers because it's a different skill. And I think, you know, if you're doing something in schools, you know, or in a library situation where you're interacting with an audience, you can't have someone saying, well, I like to write in my little room and I spend up. You know, it's not interesting. You've got to have a show, which is why the likes of myself or Liz or Steve Skidmore or whatever work well, because, you know, we've got that interaction with the audience. So, yeah, after a couple of years, I'd found I'd sort of got a few recommendations and I went down to 2 days teaching and 3 days freelance. And looking back now, the school were very cooperative with me and they were very helpful. And, you know, allowed me to build it up a little bit at a time. So I wasn't going from having a job to having no job. I just had less of a job. And then I built the poetry up. And over the next 4 or 5 years, I was doing it 4 days a week until I eventually cut out my life. I got it down to 1 day a week, actually, the teaching. And then I was turning down work because I was getting offered, can you come to Taunton for a week? Or I was getting international school visits. So I'm very lucky that I've been to Argentina, I've been to Singapore, I've been to Malaysia. Wow. You can't go there for 3 days. So I took the plunge and sort of gave up my last day. And Yeah, it's been like that for the last 30-odd years, really. I started getting poems in anthologies, and then I sent a few ideas into publishers, and that sort of happened, you know, again, gradually. So I started getting, because I used to self-publish my work and just sell it in schools. So, you know, I go into school, do an event, sell the books, and that was great. So when Macmillan got involved, the publishers I work with, you know, and I've worked with them for 25 years, I've probably done, I don't know, 30, 40 anthologies and books. I've sold over 1 million books with Macmillan, actually. And I think the book that changed it was The Works, when Literacy Hour came in, all those years ago, it's exactly 23 years ago, because I remember the book was being edited as my daughter was born, and my editor, she was about to give birth to her son as well. So it was a very fraught time.
Yeah.
But it is the Works was like a massive book, an anthology, like the Poetry Bible, that's so, as teachers have called it. So every title of poem you need. And that sort of gave me, I suppose, a bigger platform. So it built up over a period of time. And looking back now, you think, well, I've done quite a lot. But it didn't all happen at once. It happened slowly. It's like anything, you know. You know, people talk to each other, and you get a bit of work here, and you get a bit of work there, and you build up relationships with people like yourselves. And again, I'm trying to think when I started working with Hull Libraries, and it's years and years ago.
And you had a connection with a local primary school, didn't you, in Hull?
Well, Long Hill Primary School, yeah. I've worked with them probably for the last 10, 12 years. And again, pre-COVID was different. It's been a bit different since COVID, but then everything else. But I was their patron of reading, which meant I went into the school maybe four or five times during the year. So you build up a relationship with the children. Because normally, you know, the vast majority of my school visits or library visits are one-offs. You know, you go into a school, you do an assembly for the whole school, then you go around classes and you do half an hour in Key Stage 1 or 45 minutes in Key Stage 2 classes, get them to write their own poems, that sort of thing. And that's the normal day. The nice thing about the Long Hill residency was that I worked there 3 or 4 days every year, sometimes a few more. And you're working with children again and again and build up relationships with the staff and the pupils. And you're taking the work on. And yeah, I'm not just doing my favourite workshops. They're saying, well, we're doing about Romans, or we're doing about space, or whatever it is. And you can build in my workshops with their curriculum so that it fits in. So it's a real relationship. And then as a result of that, it was bizarre, because I was talking to the head, and he said, hey, what have you been doing last week? I said, I was with a mate of mine. I said, oh, actually, he was from Hull, because obviously from Hull, you remember the House Martins. Stan, the guitarist at the House Martins, really good friend of mine. And in fact, he was instrumental in me starting writing poems for children, because he started writing for children after he left the House Martins, about the same time as I was starting writing for kids as well. Anyway, but, you know, Stan and myself, for a while, we did a little double act, where he played ukulele and sang, and I wrote songs for him, and we did poems together, and we played ukulele together, and and we'd had a week in Taunton, because he lives in Bristol. And so the head said, what are you doing last week? So I was with a mate of mine. In fact, he's from Hull, ex-pop star Stan Cullimore. And he said, oh, what are you doing? So we're doing schools. He writes songs with the kids and tells stories. And he said, oh, will you come to our school? I said, well, will you pay him? He went, yeah. He said, well, he'll come then. And then I think the next time I met a guy called, I met up with a guy called Henry Priestman. Now, Henry Priestman is a songwriter who's originally from Hull, but he was in a band called The Christians. And again, in the 80s, he wrote loads of songs for them, things like Forgotten Town and Ideal World. And he goes into schools and plays ukulele. So I had the same conversation with the head at Long Hills. They said, oh, he's from Hull. Will he come in? I said, yeah. Will he pay me? Yeah, I'll come in. So we had this situation where for a couple of years, there was Stan, Henry and myself working in Long Hill Primary School, writing poems and songs and stories. And it's great because you've got two ex-pop stars, you know, and me. And I was the famous one. It was great because the kids had no idea who Stan and Henry were.
It
was the 80s. And then we showed them videos of Happy Hour or Forgotten Town. What? That's you? Yeah. But it was great. So we had this interaction of the three of us. And we had this thing called the Poetry Factor, I think it was called. We did it every year. We were the judges, and we got the kids to, they had to learn a poem off by heart. They could choose any poem they wanted. It doesn't have to be one of mine or want a stanza or whatever, choose any poem they want, but they've got to learn it off by heart, and then they've got to perform it. So you could do it in, so it was a poem about witches, you could do it in costume or whatever. And we were the judges. It was like the X Factor. I said, they were all nice.
So when you're looking at poems, how do you start? Where do you begin? You know, do you ever, do you have a set method that you go by? Do they just pop in your head? Do you write stuff down so you don't forget it and revisit it later? What's your format?
All of those, really. I mean, if I'm writing poems for children, I mean, I'm going to give you two examples of things. And again, one is pre-COVID, one is post-COVID. I mean, I always have a notebook with me, and I'll write stuff down, and you get ideas, things that people say, things that people do, or, you know, things that I think, oh, that's going to be a good poem. Or sometimes, you know, you'll get publishers saying, I want poems about space. I want poems about dragons. You know, John Foster and Corky Paul did loads of anthologies like dragon poems, dinosaur poems, monster poems, space poems, football poems, pet poems. And then you think, well, what can I write about that's going to be entertaining for children and also a bit different than everybody else's? Because they're going to get loads of submissions. You know, it's not like it is a competition in one sense, but, you know, if there's only a certain number of poems going in the book and it's a book of pet poems, well, loads of people got to write about cats. How can I make my cat poem different than theirs? You know, if it's about magic, how can I make my witch poem better or different or from a different angle that means it's going to get chosen? So sometimes you write with that in mind. Sometimes things happen, well, I've got to write a poem about that. That's a funny situation. But always I'll write the ideas down, and I'll always have the, you know, my notebook here. They always start in a notebook, longhand. I very rarely write straight at the computer. If I'm doing prose, which I very rarely do, but if I'm doing anything prose based, I can do that straight on the computer. But poems, invariably 99% of the time, I have to start on a notepad. But then I like the process of typing them up, because when you type them up, that's the second or third edit, and I find myself changing things as I type. But then the next stage is you try it out in front of an audience. I always say to children, it's not what it looks like that's important, it's what it sounds like. And it doesn't matter whether the poem rhymes or not. I think the sound of the words is really important, so I'll always try them out loud, even if I'm just reading them to myself in my room. You know, there'll be a vocalization of those words. Yeah, what was got on the page isn't always comfortable to say. There may be, you know, just some syllables that don't work together, or some words that are clunky. And certainly with the performance poetry, you know, you find very quickly which bits work and which bits don't. So that's the way I've approached the sort of children's poems over the years. And obviously, you know what I always say to children and staff when I go into schools, when I do the assembly, you know, the 45 minutes an hour that I do, I wouldn't say they're the best poems I've ever written, but I would say they're the best poems for that situation when you're meeting children for the first time. You know, I've got some poems I'm really proud of in terms of the subject matter or the structure or the writing, but they're a bit serious, and they're not the ones that are going to turn the children onto poetry. Whereas if you do a poem called "The Toilet Seat Has Teeth," then people like it. Exactly. You know, you're giggling.
That's
already.
The key, isn't it? Because you've got to work to the audience, and it depends what mood the children are that day or what the audience are like that day. And you have to feed off what you've got there and then live, haven't you? So it's a real skill, I think, because when you might have a set list in your head of what you're going to do that day. Do you ever tweak it or change it because you're thinking, this isn't working, I need to go at another angle?
Yeah, I mean, generally, if I've got a school assembly and it's a primary school, you know, key stage one, key stage two, I know pretty much what I'm going to do. You know, I know how I'm going to start, I know how I'm going to finish. What sometimes happens is, you know, various things happen. You know, somebody might say something. Oh, that reminds me of a poem. I mean, I was in a school the other day, and the football team had just won a competition, and the goalie was the captain, and the head teacher said, Did you play well? He said, I touched the ball twice. You know, so I just said, well, that was very lazy of you, wasn't it? You know, not pulling you away. But I've got a poem called "The Goalie with Expanding Hands," so I'll put that into the show because of that. And then sometimes you might find that, and it's not necessarily whether the kids are particularly loud or naughty. You might just have a very echoey hall.
Yeah.
So that every acoustic is amplified. So then you know. And if you've got a very big audience, I'll do a lot of call and response because it's a way of controlling that situation. You know, so I'll say something, they say something, And a lot of the poems would be that. If you've got a smaller hall with the better acoustics, and maybe you've got key stage two, you can do what you call, I suppose, a bit more what you call stand up. Do you know what I mean? So you're talking a bit in between the poem, and also you sort of get the audience involved.
Yeah.
Because right from the very first poem, I'll get the audience involved, because that also breaks down the barriers between the performer and the audience. And I think that's important, because I think if they're involved, there's that positivity and that energy you can then take on. Whereas if they don't get involved, I won't say it's difficult, because it very rarely happens that they don't get involved now, because I've been doing it so many years that you think, well, if that doesn't happen, I can do that. You've got those tricks as a performer up your sleeve. And like I say, there are some times where you've got a really loud audience, and they're not particularly being naughty, but it's just the lots of kids. And I'll do a whispering poem, and that brings it right down. And they think, oh, we're doing a whispering poem. The teachers and me know that I'm actually controlling that situation. They're the teaching skills as well as performance skills.
Yeah.
I think you find that the right time to do the right poem, but certainly in assembly or that performance situation, I would say that, the poems I do there, like I said, they're not necessarily the best ones I've done, but they are the best ones for that situation. And you can't imagine, the kids having a better hour with anybody, really. And that sounds incredibly big-headed, but you know what I mean by that?
And there's a lot of elements to what you're delivering, because it's about language and rhythm and words and getting children confident with using different words and trying stuff. And they might make a mistake, but that's okay. And the teachers love that, don't they? Because it helps them compose in English and helps them think about it.
Certainly when you do the workshops, because the workshops when I'm working with a class, I very rarely get the kids actually physically writing. I can do workshops where they write, but the problem with that is it then becomes a bit like a lesson, and I'm a bit like a teacher. Whereas what I tend to do is have a flip chart, say, right, we're going to start off with a title, or we'll start off with a subject, and you're going to give me some ideas. I'm going to tell you how to perform those ideas. I'll write down their ideas. And again, the call and response, because it's an instant poem, it's instant success. And I think that's important, that you make people feel confident about, yes, we can do this. And you've got an instant thing, but also once you've done it once, a couple of times, well, that line, there's too many syllables, we can change it, it works, but how can we make it work better? So then you start thinking about vocabulary and choice of words. I always say it's the best words in the best order, and ideas like a row of dominoes. You can have, 100 dominoes, but you've got to knock the first one down to get the 100th one. And it might be the 100th one that's the best idea, but you've got to get all the others before you get there. So it's a process. There's no right and wrong way of doing it. And it's just making it accessible for... And teachers as well. I mean, the teachers yesterday said, I couldn't believe that we got that list and then suddenly it turned into a poem. Well, it's like me teaching my favourite lesson again and again. And also I think that with teachers as well, with poetry, because of the poems you had to study at school, which are sort of, semi-intellectual and rhyming are very serious, you have this image that all poetry has to be like that, whereas with performance poetry, it demystifies that. And almost anything you write can be turned into a performance poem if you've got the rhythm. And then you start putting choruses in and structures and stuff like that. So that's the way the children's poetry works. I mentioned COVID and...
You've got a bit of a story with this, haven't you? Because it's an ongoing project. Should we call it a project? I don't know.
Well, it is, yeah. COVID changed everybody's lives. But, I mean, certainly for those of us like, sort of Liz and Steve and myself who work in schools, we suddenly had nowhere to go on a daily basis. Our lives changed overnight. I that 20th of March, school stopped. And I didn't go into school for 6 or 7 months. Employment stopped. And then I did a few Zoom sessions with yourselves and with the school's library services throughout the country. And that was online. That was quite interesting. But what I started to do, it was the first Thursday of COVID. Remember when we clapped outside our doorsteps for the NHS? It became a bit convoluted and corny after a while, but that first one was quite moving because it was a very strange situation. I mean, it seems like a lifetime ago now. A different world, doesn't it, where we weren't allowed to go out and nobody saw each other. But I wrote a poem about it and I put it on Facebook and Twitter the next day and people responded. And Chris Riddell, the illustrator, he does a cartoon every day, a political cartoon every day, and shares it. I thought, well, maybe I can write a poem every day. I thought, I'll write a poem. I'll do it as a COVID diary, because I think, like everybody, we thought, it'll be over in a couple of months. I'll do a poem a day for a couple of months. I've never had the time to write a poem a day. So I did. And I started putting them on Facebook and Twitter. And I'm still doing it. I'm up to poem 1,150.
It's incredible.
The weird thing was, it's almost redefined me as a poet who writes for grown-ups as well.
It's such a commitment. Don't you get stressed every day thinking, what do I do today?
Well, yes and no. I like the challenge. And, you know, like I say, it started off thinking, right, I'll do it while COVID's on. And then I thought, well, actually, I'll do it as a year. Because then you've got a diary, 365. I thought, that's good. I got to 365. I thought, I want to get to 500. That's a nice round figure, 500.
As you set yourself personal challenges.
Yeah. And then I thought, if I got to 500, I might as well do 1,000. Sorry, I'm reaching for my book here. I don't know if you've seen this. That's the first volume of...
The Man Who Launched, what's it say?
The Man Who Launched 1,000 Poems.
Volume 1.
Fighting Talk. That was the first. In fact, Chris Riddell did the illustrations in this. But a mate of mine who writes poems for grown-ups had had his books published by a publisher called Flapjack Press. And I just said, you think they'd be interested? He said, well, drop them a line. And I must admit, I sent the most cursory email I've ever sent to a publisher. The guy's called Paul Needs at Flapjack Press. And I put, dear Paul, Henry Normal's put me in touch with you. I usually write poems for children. Obviously, I can't at the moment because of COVID. I'm doing a poem a day as a COVID diary. Is this any interest? I sent in the poem. It was literally, I'd never met the guy. It was literally that sort of email. And it was the Thursday before Father's Day. And he emailed back in the afternoon and said, dear Paul, thanks for the email. That sounds an interesting idea. Give me a ring on Monday. I rang him on Monday. And he said, yeah, let's do a book. Now, we actually turned that into four paperback books. And then when we got to 1,000, we did the two hardback books. I mean, I love the fact that's a hardback book. It didn't start off as a project that I was going to publish. It was something that I started doing. And I thought, well, maybe there's an interest. And people bought it. And then they bought the next one. And it sort of, you know, gained a following, I suppose, on Twitter. And you know, my Facebook friends, you know, that I can guarantee that, you know, every day 30, 40 people will either like the poem or some of them will share it or comment on it. But some days I've had a couple of hundred likes. And you're thinking, that's really interesting, because suddenly I, you know, as a writer, as a poet, I had no audience, as is a physical audience in a school. Then I got this virtual audience. And so therefore, I will write a poem every day. And you say, does it get stressed? If I'm really busy, you can always tell the days I'm really busy because it's usually a haiku. Yeah. Three lines, but I can get away with that. Or I've got some poems that are non-date specific. Because obviously what I do now, I look at what's happening in the news. And something's happening, like the other day, it was about, I think yesterday's poem was about porta cabins, because the education secretary had said that that children really love porta cabins. You're thinking, no, they don't. So I wrote a poem called Everyone Loves a Porta Cabin. No, they didn't, you know. But sometimes, you know, it's about what's been happening in the news, or football, or the Lionesses winning the Euros, or people. You know, Michael Parkinson passed away, so I wrote one about him. I'm at the age where I've been to sort of 5 funerals this year, so there's been lots of poems about death and funerals. In fact, today's poem is about a guy I knew from a festival for many, many years who's passed away. And he's, you know, he's a decent age, but he's a beautiful guy. And he always said, oh, you're a beautiful human person. And he was always very positive. And you know, I've got great memories of him. So, you know, some of them are personal. Some of them are social. Some of them are just jokes. I mean, there is going to be a poem about Bishop's Itchington, which is the place I was in yesterday. You know, it's a great name.
What a lovely way to capture everything you've just mentioned. You're literally capturing it in a poem, aren't you? It's just like a historical memoir going back, isn't it, over everything. If you think now, did you say you're 1,000?
1,151.
Wow, it's incredible.
And also looking back, you know, especially when things have happened. I mean, you know, if Michael Parkinson's died, or a guy called Mike Yarwood, and again, you know, there are a lot of people from my childhood, whether it's footballers or sort of stars, if you like, who are on telly who are dying, or at that age where they're passing away. You think, well, that's part of your childhood, and that's them, the sort of the memories, but the collective memories, because you do a poem about Michael Parkinson or Mike Yarwood or whatever, and people, well, yeah, we remember that. And one of the kids said to me yesterday, what do you like best about poetry? I said, I like the fact it can mark occasions. You know, it's a way of defining a situation. And as I said, I've been to quite a few funerals this year. two friends of mine who are the same age as me and my mother and a couple of others, but three of them I've actually done poems at. And so obviously those poems are different than the ones you do in schools, you know, because you're almost writing as a mirror of everybody else's feelings about that person. I mean, your own personal feelings as well. In fact, one of the poems I wrote a couple of weeks ago was that the poet isn't a preacher or a prophet, but a mirror. You might hold the mirror at a slightly different angle, but you're reflecting other people's feelings, and that's your job, rather than saying, I am the big important poet, listen to my words. It's like, hopefully I'm writing what you feel. And that's been one of the things about the post or the COVID poems is people go, yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there, Paul, and that's what we feel as well. And I think that's been very encouraging as well.
So what do you do for hobbies and to relax when you're not trying to think of a poem a day?
Play the ukulele.
You do actually, don't you?
Yeah, so I got a ukulele for Christmas sort of, I don't know, nearly 20 years ago. And thought, well, I could use it. I was quite like George Formby with a little stick of Blackpool Rock and when I'm cleaning windows. And...
Was you self-taught?
Yeah, but then in the last few years, I've joined, we have a little ukulele group in Retford where I live, and it's on a Monday night, and it's in a pub. And all you do is you choose songs to sing, and you sing them. And I'm the youngest there, or one of the youngest there. It's you know, I'm the youth policy at the age of 62. And so you always start with Bad Moon Rising, and then we've got Whiskey in the Jar, Jambalaya, and then 8 days a week or Sunny Afternoon or whatever. And it's great fun. But the nice thing about playing ukulele with other people is, you know, it improves your ukulele playing. I'm not a singer at all. I wish I was a singer. You know, when I first started writing as a teenager, I wanted to be a songwriter. And my favourite band was Slade and of Merry Christmas, Everybody fame. And I wanted to play guitar and sing songs, and I couldn't do that at all. So I started writing poems mainly through people like Roger McGough, the Liverpool poet. I will say Roger McGough is a poet who made me want to write poems. And John Cooper Clarke, who's a poet from Manchester, performance poet, he's the first poet I ever saw live, and he's the first poet who made me want to perform poems. And those, I suppose those are like, you know, general goalposts. So lots of other poets in between, but I would say those are the two main influences to begin with, Roger McGough and John Cooper Clarke. And in fact, the first poem I learnt off by heart because I wanted to was one of John Cooper Clarke's called I Married a Monster from Outer Space. And that was... a science fiction film he'd seen. He's from Manchester. Speaks like that, John Cooper Clarke. And the first two verses were like this. I fell in love with an alien being whose skin was jelly, whose teeth were green. She had the big bug eyes, death ray glare, feet like porter wings, purple air. I was over the moon, asked her back to my place. Then I married the monster from outer space. Our days were numbered, our nights were spent in a rent-free furnished oxygen tent, where a cyborg chef served up moonbeams, done super rapid on a laser beam. I needed nutrition to keep up the pace when I married the monster from outer space. And it goes on for it. Two or three verses like that. And in fact, I stole the rhythm of that for a poem called When the Wasp Flew Up My Brother's Shorts, which I do with kids. Family fun filled holiday, seaside football match of the day on the beach to score 9-9 when the match went into injury time. We soon forgot a day for sports when the wasp flew up my brother's shorts.
Yeah.
But yeah, talking about the music and hobbies. So yeah, I've always written, I've always wanted to write songs. So there's been a couple of projects that have been going on. Me and my friend Les Glover write songs. And I met Les through Henry Priestman, I mentioned earlier, the guy from Hull. And Henry and Les do a little double act together. But Les has become one of my best mates, and we started writing songs together. And I do these events in Retford called Pies, Peas and Performances once a month on a Saturday night, and we have pies and peas, and then somebody comes and performs. So Les has been, Henry and Les have been a few times. And I got in touch with Don Powell. Now, Don Powell is a drummer out of Slade. I'd done a book of Slade poems. He'd done a quote for me. And I was emailing him. I said, well, he'd just done his biography. That was it. And I said, do you fancy coming over and doing an event? And it'll be a bit like This Is Your Life. I'll ask you questions and Les will do a couple of songs. And, you know, several emails went backwards and forwards. And I didn't think it was going to happen. And then one day, he must have been sat by his computer and we had this like email conversation. He went, yeah, I'm over in the... Because he lives in Denmark. He says, I'm over in the country... it was like, a Tuesday in November or a Monday in November. I said, all right, then we'll do it. He came over and he told loads of stories. He was brilliant. We got on really... I've never met him before. Well, I've met him once before, but he wouldn't have remembered. But and Les did a couple of songs. And at the end, he said, do you know what, lads? I've not enjoyed myself as much as that for a long time. Can I come and do another one and tell you more stories about Ozzy Osbourne or the Beatles or Aerosmith, or the fact that when Slade were on tour in America, the Eagles supported them, you know, weird stuff, you know. Anyway, so he came back. In the meantime, Les and myself wrote a couple of songs, and Les played them at this event. And we just said, look, if we ever get round to recording these, is there any chance you drum on them for us? And he went, of course I will, lads. We're going, me and Les, we're the same age. We grew up in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, watching Top of the Pops and watching Slade. And suddenly, the drummer out of Slade is drumming on our songs. And we're in the studio. He says, I think I'll do the same shuffle as he did on Cos I Love You, which is one of their big hits. Is that all right? We're going, yeah, of course it is. And we had two songs. And because he was so good, we had the studio, a little studio booked in Retford for a day. And by lunchtime, he'd nailed the two. He'd been through them twice, got it. He says, you've got anything else? And Les, he's sort of lying a little bit. Yeah, we've got a little of the devil. What should we do then? Oh, all right then. So about 4 o'clock, he says, oh, we've done five songs. That's half an album. Should we do an album? Me and Les are going, all right, you've talked into it. So we did this little album, which is some poems, some songs. And then after that, we started writing some more. I'm now holding up a vinyl album called Just My Cup of Tea.
Oh, fantastic.
And there's myself, Les and Don Powell there. That came out a couple of years ago. That got reviewed in Classic Rock magazine, actually. 8 out of 10.
Oh, well done. What an experience. It just shows you, doesn't it? If you just try these things and ask the question, look where you end up.
What's the worst you can say? You could have said, no, lads, I'm busy. And yet, here we are. I'm in a band with the man from Slade. Yeah, it's a hobby, but it's great because it's creative, it's fulfilling, and you know, we're now thinking, well, hang on, Don's one of our mates. He's the bloke who was on my wall.
Yeah.
You know, when the Slade posters on my wall when I was 12 or 13, and now he's one of my friends. It's like saying John Cooper Clarke and Roger McGough I've met, and Noddy Alder, the lead singer of Slade. In fact, we do prize piece of performances. His wife Susan is an author. She does chick lit, I suppose, rom-coms, you know. I mean, she's great, really, really good presence, and she's funny. And she's got a book called, I'm looking on my shelf now, it's called Shake It Up Beverly, which is about a woman in her 40s who dips her toe into the waters of online dating to hilarious consequences. But she's a Beatles fan. So it's set against the backdrop of Liverpool. And then she's got one called Rock and Rolls. And that's set against the backdrop of Memphis. And she came, she'd been to Pies and Peas. And she emailed and said, oh, we love your event. Can I come back again? Well, yeah, of course you can. Anyway, she came back to do the Rock and Rolls one. And she brought Noddy Alder with her husband, Nod. So he walks in and went, all right, Paul, how are you doing, my man? You're good. And you know, so Noddy Alder's come to a church hall in Retford with his wife while she talks about it. And the weird thing was, I've got this great, I'll show you the photo sometime, but the church had a fair in the afternoon. There were some marrows. We always have a raffle at the at our Pies Beans performances, and they're always like rubbish prizes. You know, there'll be tickets for the next event, there'll be a pie, there'll be some flowers, a bit of bottle of wine, there'll be some vinyl albums from a jumble sale that are rubbish. But we had these marrows, so Noddy Alder raffle two marrows. He started the raffle at half eight. He's still talking, telling stories at 9:10. Brilliant night. So I've got a photo of me and Noddy. I've got my ukulele. He's got a marrow. It looks like a George Formby song.
Thanks for listening. We're now available on all the major podcast platforms. Just search for Hull Libraries. So if you enjoyed this podcast, you can get all the latest episodes as soon as they're out.
In the meantime, if you want to check out any of the services at Hull Libraries, please go to our website, hcandl.co.uk/libraries. Or we also have channels on all the social medias, including Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening and see you next time.